Okay, so welcome again to Yehoshua Katz in YU Smicha, and has spoken several times at our Parsha Shir. And again, I thank him again. Without further ado, Yehoshua Katz.
Thank you, Harry. Thank you for organizing the Shir. So always a pleasure to be back in Rina and share some story with you and learn together a little bit. It's like my home crowd here. Okay. All right, so let's get started. So I wanted to discuss tonight perhaps what's the most interesting kriya of the different kriyos that we read on Yom HaKippurim. That would be the last kriya that we read, which is Sefer Yonah, the Matthir, for Mincha. So certainly it's the most interesting to all of us just intuitively. It's the story that we grow up with since childhood. And sometimes it's precisely those stories that we are familiar with from such a young age that we kind of glance over, we know the basic story, but we never return to it. And then we don't get to see the depth and profundity that really kind of spans throughout the story until we look at it again with more maturity and with a better eye to really pick up on all the messages and the themes that are coming out of the story. So I was hoping that we could accomplish some of that tonight. The main question, really, is why do we even read Yonah on Yom Kippur? So you might think that that's really, like Rabbi Adler would say, it's a bonehead question, right? It's an airhead question. I mean, what do you mean, why do you read Yonah on Yom Kippur? Because Yonah's all about tshuva, and Yom Kippur is all about tshuva. So of course you read Yonah on Yom Kippur. But if you stop to think about it for a second, so you realize that that's really not so simple. Because on all the other Tanyos Tzibor, we also read a Haftorah and Mincha that talks about tshuva. Even on Tisha B'Av, we read that Haftorah. Every other Tanis Tzibor, that's the Haftorah we read at Mincha. And even if you didn't want to pick Dershu Hashem V'Himatza'o, there are certainly many other stories throughout Nevi'im that speak about Tshuva. So why would it be the story of Yonah and Nineveh in specific? And to accentuate this question, we might even pick up on a more basic question that the Radak poses in his introduction to the Sefer. Whenever I think of the Radak, I think of my mother, Rivka Devorah Katz. So oftentimes in our house, my mom says that she can pass on certain shilas because she's the Radak. So, but now we're going to talk about Rav David Kimberly. Okay, so the Radak asks a very basic question about the Sefer of Yonah, and he says, why is Yonah even included in the corpus of Tanakh? Why is it one of the Chavtalot Sefer Tanakh? So why would you think that it wouldn't be? So he explains. Because Yonah, really, at its core, is a story about a non-Jewish nation. It's a story about Nineveh, which is part of Meleches Ashur, part of the Assyrian Empire. And therefore, says Radak, we would have thought a priori that the story of Nineveh would not be included, and the story of Yonah would not be included in Tanakh. Because after all, Radak is coming in with a really bona fide assumption, which is brought down in the Medrash, of Nevuah Shenitzach HaLedoros Nechteva, Nevuah She'ena Nitzach HaLedoros Ena Nechteva. How do we decide which Nevi'im are included in Tanakh, which stories, which prophecies are included? There were thousands and thousands of prophecies that have transpired throughout history. It's not like just that the Chavdalid Svarim or that Torah and Nevi'im are the only instances of prophecy in our history. That's not the case at all. There are many, many, many more prophecies than the ones that we know that we have in text. So how do we decide which ones are included in the corpus and which ones are not? So Chazal explained that the ones that are included are the ones that have messages for generations and generations, for posterity. But the ones that were basically like the Tzorech Sha'a, the ones that were necessary for that generation, for that people, but not for all people, for not for all generations of Jews, were not necessarily included. So then the Radak's question becomes really compelling. Because if this story is about a story about a non-Jewish nation, so what are we supposed to take from it? What's the message, what's the lesson that the Jewish nation is supposed to learn from a story about a non-Jewish nation? So that's the next question as to why Yonah is included in Tanakh. So that only reinforces the original question that we posed at the very beginning, which is why would we specifically pick a story that the Radak even asks why it's even included in Tanakh to begin with? Why would we pick that story to read on Yom Kippur, a story about a non-Jewish nation? Why don't we speak about tshuva for ourselves? There are many instances of Nevi'im warning the Jewish nation to do tshuva. So in order to answer that question, I thought it was incumbent upon us really to take a closer look at the story of Yonah in specific, to to kind of re-encounter and re-experience Yonah's journey, and thereby, hopefully, by the conclusion of the shiur, to try to come up with one or two approaches as to why this story in specific would be one that is so apt for the mincha of Yom HaKippurim, for the climax as we're about to approach Ni'ilah. So let's start off in the very beginning of Yonah. Let's refresh our memories a little bit. So if you look at source number two, so the Navi states, "Vayhi dvar Hashem al Yonah ven amitai lemor, kum lichel Nineveh ha'ir ha'gedola ukra aleha, ki al asara asam lefanai." So Hashem says to Yonah, go to Nineveh, because their horrible deeds have appeared before me. And vayakom Yonah levroach tarshish am lefnei Hashem, vayirad yofo vayimtzo niya ba'ar sashish. So Yonah runs away, he flees from God's mission, and he runs towards Tarshish, and then we're familiar with the continuation of the story. He comes onto a boat, the boat starts rocking in a windy and stormy storm, and then eventually the sailors find out that it's Yonah who's responsible for the storm, and then Yonah's thrown into the sea, swallowed up by the fish, spat out by the fish, then called upon again to go to Nineveh, tells Nineveh to do tshuva, Nineveh does tshuva, Yonah gets angry, and then Hashem comes along and teaches Yonah a lesson, and says, no, you shouldn't be angry, what happened here was exactly what should have happened, everything is good. That's the basic outline of the story. So the most obvious question to begin with, when we just after reading three psukim from the Sefer, is why does Yonah run away? Right. So this is not my question. This question has been posed for time immemorial. But what's really Yonah's motivation here to run away? So lest we think that Yonah's running away here just out of inconvenience, so the Navi goes out of its way to stress how perturbed Yonah was by the mission that God had given him. If you take a look at source number three, so we're going to jump to the last parak of the Sefer, and this parak follows up on Nineveh having done tshuva already, as we just mentioned, and the parak begins as follows: Vayera el Yonah ra'a gidola vayi harlan. You couldn't have more of an emphatic statement about how infuriated Yonah was at the notion of Nineveh doing tshuva. And then Yonah explains to Hashem why he actually ran away. Vayispalel al Hashem vayomar, Ano Hashem, halo zed devari ad hayosi el admasi. This has been the thing that has just captured me my entire life. Al kein kidamti levarach tashisha. This is the reason why I fled. Ki yadati ki ata kel chanun virachum, erach apayim virav chesed v'nicham al hara'a. So Yonah gives us the answer to this question straight. Right? He explicates it himself. Why does he run away? So the pasuk says, "Ki yadati ki ata kel chanun v'rachum," because I knew forever that you were a merciful God. So that seems a little bit strange. That's the reason why Yonah runs away from a divine mission, because God is merciful. Isn't God's mercy something that we're impressed by, something that we try to model? The halachta b'drachav, right? So mahu rachum ma'afata hayechanun. Just as God is merciful, so too you should be merciful. So Yonah, one of the Nevi'im who is able to receive messages from God, didn't understand that. That was something that bothered Yonah. How could it be that God's midah of mercy was what forced Yonah to flee, was what forced Yonah to run away from calling Nineveh to tshuva? And in addition to that, we really see throughout Perek Aleph, I'm not going to go through all of the textual evidence as to how this is so, but we see throughout Perek Aleph how bothered Yonah really was by God's request to go to Nineveh. Yonah is portrayed throughout the parak. You can take a look on your own if you have time. He's portrayed throughout the parak as incredibly passive. The second that he gets the call to go to Nineveh, he stops speaking. We don't hear a word from Yonah until Pasuk Tes, 9 psukim into the Sefer, despite the fact that Yonah is the main character of the Sefer. Not only that, but the psukim go out of their way to kind of contrast Yonah as being passive with inanimate objects being active. The Navi speaks about the boat as chishiva lehishaver, as if it expressed, it's a kind of personification, but as if the boat itself expressed thought to break. Whereas Yonah, who's the Navi, who's the actual human being, who's the one called upon to action, is portrayed specifically as the most passive. So passive that really he's willing to give up his life. Sa'uni vahati luni al hayam, he tells the sailors to throw him into the sea. He wants nothing to do with anything that God has instructed him to do. So the entire implication that comes from the Pesukim, both from Yonah's response himself in Perek Dalet, and from the portrayal of Yonah throughout Perek Aleph, really hits home the message that Yonah has absolutely no interest in what God has told him to do, and not out of inconvenience, but rather out of some principled objection. He's incredibly bothered, disturbed by what God tells him to do, and therefore he becomes paralyzed and cannot proceed with God's mission. So the question is, what is this thing that is really holding Yonah back? So the first, perhaps most simple answer, and this is the way that I used to think about the story when before I looked into it a little bit more. But I think it's somewhat compelling, but we'll pose some challenges to it in just a few moments. But the first and most simple answer, I think, is brought down in the Sefer in Da'at Mikra. So if you turn to source number 4, we're not going to read it inside right now. So the Da'at Mikra explains that we have to have a very nuanced reading of the pasuk in Perek Dalet, pasuk Bet. So if you turn back to source number 3, okay, you have to put your reading glasses on. Okay, here we go. So Yonah is speaking about the midos of the Ribono Shalom. And of course, this already alludes to another instance. Where else do we find the Yud Gimel Midos of Hashem? Moshe, right? In Parshas Kisisa, in reaction to Klal Yisrael's Chet with regard to Chet HaEgel. Okay, so everybody knows the Yud Gimel Midos. We've been saying them for everyone here who's been saying Slichos. We've been saying them for quite a while now. And we will say them. I said for everyone here who has been saying Slichos. That's a specific. Okay. Anyway. But even so, I'm sure that Paula is very much familiar with the Yud Gimel Midos. So let's ask Paula herself. Okay, so Paula, I'm going to put you on the spot. A little law school here. Yeah. What's the difference? Huh?
No image.
Exactly. Have you heard that before? Or you just noticed it now?
I went to share.
Really? By who?
Oh,
okay. So maybe I'll be Mechavi to someone else and stuff. You'll have to tell me where Rabbi Angel said. Okay. So the first approach is brought down in Da'at Mikra is based on this nuanced reading of the Pasuk, where Yonah omits the Midah of Emes. Yonah omits the Midah of truth, of justice, from the characterization of God. So what are we to make of that? Why would Yonah omit the Midah of Emes? So perhaps what this glaring omission is coming to teach us is that what is holding Yonah back here is Yonah's inability, his inability to reconcile the existence of two seemingly contradictory midos. On the one hand, God is a merciful God, Ki ata kel chanun v'rachum, as Yonah says, and on the other hand, he's supposed to be a God of emes. But how could it be that emes and rachamim, that mercy and justice, go hand in hand? How can they coexist? So that obviously is a very interesting logical query, right? The way that we think about justice is is tit for tat. I did something wrong, there's a consequence that happens to me, right? If I steal from you, I have to return the money, right? If I cause you harm, I have to pay for damages, right? That's just to take two simple examples from the world of monetary law. But this certainly should apply throughout everything that happens in life. That's the simple understanding of justice. But the simple understanding of compassion and of tshuva, right, is that you can do something, and then after regretting it, feeling shame for it, expressing the fact that you did it, admitting to it, saying sorry, taking it upon yourself never to do it again, then no consequence afterwards. Maybe not no consequence, but certainly a lesser consequence, something that's not in accordance with the action that you took. So how could it be, from a logical perspective, that Midas HaDin and Midas HaRachamim, Emes and Rachamim, can coexist? So that is the way that Da'at Mikra wants to explain what is really bothering Yonah here. And if so, then what's the nature of the disturbance that's really capturing Yonah? So the nature of it is it's a really theological question, right? Yonah's bothered by some quality that he knows to be true about God, but he doesn't understand how it could be true. And therefore, says Yonah, you, God, the God of MS, you're going to send me on a mission to go get Ninveh to do tshuva, and then you're going to express your midas harachamim? I can't do that, because I have absolutely no understanding of how that could be true. So before posing a number, I think, of serious challenges to that approach, let's first try to bring some more evidence that might possibly corroborate it. So number one, I thought that if you look throughout Perek Dalet, you'll see a really interesting kind of back and forth between two different shemos of Hashem. We know that in general, Chazal explained this very, very much, and this is also very, very true in the world of Kabbalah. And so the Shem Hashem of Yud Kei Vav Kei, Shem Havaya, reflects the Midas Harachamim of God, and Elohim reflects the Midas Hadin. Okay, so Elohim is Adnut, it's power, whereas Hashem, meaning the Shem Havaya, refers to the Midas Harachamim. So if you pay careful attention to Perek Dalet, you'll see that the psukim go back and forth in the Shem Hashem that they use. So in Pasuk, I bolded for you each instance of a Shem Hashem and which one it is. So in Pasuk Bet, it's Shem Havaya, Shem Havaya. Same thing in Gimel and Dalet. Then in Vav, we have both, Hashem and Elohim. Then Zayin Ches Tes, we have Elohim. And then in Yud, we have back to Hashem. So is this just happenstance? Is this just random? Is this just a nice kind of literary flow to keep you on the feet, to keep you up while you're trying to fall asleep during the maftir of Yonah? Or is there something really purposeful here going on in the psukim? So this is just my own thoughts. I don't have any previous evidence for this. But perhaps let's look at each instance of the chain and let's see if it accords with the content of the pasuk with which it's associated. So in pasuk Bet, Yonah is saying to Hashem, I can't believe, this has been my problem ever since I've been alive, that you are a Keel Chanun V'Rachum. So therefore, it makes a lot of sense that the Psukim would use the Shem Havaya, because that's the God who Yonah is addressing. That's the God who Yonah is talking about. Then in the next Pasuk, where Yonah says, I'd rather die than live in this type of reality. So what's making him make such a bold statement? The fact that Hashem is Keel Chanun V'Rachum. So again, it's Shem Havaya. And Pasuk Dalet following up on the same thing. Then in Pasuk Vav, we have a transition. That's my claim. We have a transition. Shem Havaya and Shem Elohim. Where the Navi is basically trying to tell us that Yonah is incorrect. It is the case that Hashem has both Midas HaRachamim and Midas HaDin. And then it transitions to Pasuk Zayin Chet and Tet, where we use the Shem Elohim. So why is the Shem Elohim used in that context? Because that's the little tidbit about the Kikayon. What happens with the Kikayon? So Hashem basically comes up to Yonah and really rebukes him, gives him a little musa shmuz, right? You Yonah, you couldn't believe how I could have mercy on the entire city of Ninveh? Well, I'm going to show you that you're going to have mercy on a little tree. Right, because I bring a tree over, it gives you shade, and then I brought over, and then I brought the sun, and then after the tree had already had willowed, and now you're struck by the light of the sun, and therefore you're really upset, and you'd rather die than live, and now you're expressing mercy for the tree, meaning you're very upset that the tree has gone out of existence. Right, so that's basically Hashem's little rebuke towards Yonah. So in that instance, God is using the Midas Hadin. He's trying to teach Yonah a lesson. I mean, he's trying to use logic in order to explain to Yonah why his original assumption was false. And then in Pasuk Yud, Vayomer Hashem atah chasta al hakikayon, asher lo amata bav lo gidato, that's where Hashem says to Yonah, Yonah, you're the one who expressed mercy for the kikayon. So I, God, Shem Havaya, Yud Kei Vav Kei, why should I not have the Midas HaRachamim for all of the city of Ninveh? So perhaps if you look at the psukim from that perspective of this wavering back and forth between Shem Havaya and Shem Elohim, right? Yod Kei Vav Kei Elohim, Midas HaRacham, Midas HaDin. So from that perspective, what the Navi is really trying to hit home, what it's trying to emphasize, is that the theme here is the coexistence of Hashem and Elohim, of Midas HaRachamim and Midas HaDin. That's what Yonah didn't understand. That's what paralyzed him to begin with. And that's the entire message of the story, really, to teach us that although it may not make sense to our human kinds of sensitivities, nonetheless, that is in truth the reality. And that's something that we have to recognize on a day of tshuva. So we'll come back to that a little bit more. Just as an extra piece, perhaps, of supporting evidence to this claim, so I saw a really interesting note, both in the Da'at Mikra and also Professor Yonatan Grossman makes this note in the Gush Sefer, on Yom Kippur, so you could take a look at that if you'd like. But what's Yonah's father's name? Yonah ben Amittai, right? So perhaps sometimes in both Torah and Nevi'im, names are used in order to convey some type of thematic message about the character. So Yonah ben Amittai from Lashon of Emet would hit home on this as well, that Yonah is really an Ish Emet, a Navi Emet. He's someone who follows the Midas Hadin, the theme of justice, and therefore he can't understand how Midas HaRacham and Midas HaDin could coexist. Now, with the time that we have left, I would like to pose, I think, a number of really concrete challenges to that approach, and then hopefully to suggest a different avenue to explain why Yonah ran away, and then bring it home to explain why Yonah is such a wonderful story to read on Yom Kippur. So challenge number one comes from source number 5. So that's on the second side of your page. That's from the Navi Yoel. This is the Haftorah that we actually read this previous Shabbat, where we had Shabbat Shuva. Right? So Yoel is a story about locusts and a famine that's about to come upon Klal Yisrael, and Yoel is basically calling Klal Yisrael to Tshuva, and he says as follows, V'kir'u levavchem, you should tear apart your hearts, you should do introspection, V'al bigdeichem, don't just do the external ripping of your clothing, V'shuvu Hashem el Hashem elokeichem, ki chanun v'rachum hu erech apayim v'rav chesed v'nicham al hara'ah. So if you take that phrase in source number 5, and then you flip your sheet, and you turn back to source number 3, and you go to Pasuk Bet, it's verbatim. Yoel and Yonah both use the exact same terminology in describing the mercy and the compassion that God exhibits. Now, no one's trying to make the claim that Yoel is the one who faces this same kind of theological quandary. He didn't run away from a divine mission. Yonah is the one who did that. So if it's really the case that this omission of Midat HaEmet in Yonah's statement is what's telling us about what's really paralyzing Yonah, then it would seem a little bit strange that Yoel would also use the same formulation. It seems more likely that this is the way that the Nevi'im describe God when they're trying to call upon his Midah of Rachamim, but not necessarily in order to distinguish it from his Midas HaDin, from the fact that we find it with regard to Yoel as well. So I think that that's one huge issue with the first approach. A second significant issue with the first approach is based on a little historical background to the Sefer of Yonah. So in source number 6, many of us may not be familiar with the fact that Yonah actually has another prophecy that's recorded in Tanakh. Not the words of the prophecy are not recorded, but he's mentioned as a Navi in Sefer Melachim Bet. It's not only in Sefer Yonah, in Treyasar, where we meet Yonah, it's also in source number 6 in Melachim Bet. And the story there is about Yoravam ben Yoash, not the original Yoravam, a later Yoravam. And basically, the historical climate is as follows. So, Klal Yisrael is not doing well. It's during Bayis Rishon. We're serving a lot of Avodah Zarah. Our kings are horrible people who are basically motivating us to sin more, and they themselves are sinning as well. That's obviously the continuing theme throughout Sefer Melachim. And so we're basically on the brink of losing the Beis HaMikdash due to our despicable behavior. So at that time, so it's recorded in Sefer Melachim that Yonah ben Amittai had a certain nevuah. And I'll say this outside, but you could look inside if you'd like. So Yonah is said there to have basically promised, he guaranteed through nevuah, that Klal Yisrael at the time, or that the Melech, would be successful in extending the borders, the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael. At the time, we had lost some of our land, and thereby we had become more at risk to foreign capture. And with more land, we would become more secure. Right? Whenever you have more land, that's always a better thing in throughout Tanakh. Right? So Yonah, through his nevuah, makes this guarantee. Okay? So that does transpire. That happens in reality. We gain back the boundaries. Now, if we kind of think about this story for a second, we'll realize how I think it stands really in contradiction to the first approach that we suggested as to why Yonah is really perturbed in going to Nineveh. Remember, what was the approach that we outlined. So it's because Yonah was a man of emes. He couldn't understand how emes and rachamim could coexist. But in the story in Melachim, the entire Jewish nation is displaying horrible behavior. The nation's not worthy of extension of boundaries. They're not worthy through the Midas Hadin of having more success, right? Of having more security. Certainly not worthy of such things. So how could Yonah give a prophecy at the very same time that was not in accordance with the Midas Hadin and not express any type of backlash against the Ribono Shalom, not express any hesitation in making that nevuah? We don't encounter any hesitation that Yonah makes. We only hear in Malachim that Yonah did as he was told. He gave the nevuah just as Hashem told him to, that the nation would extend its boundaries. But if Yonah was really tied to the Midas Hadin, so the same way that Yonah can't come to allow a nation to do tshuva because it contradicts with the Midas Hadin, so too he shouldn't be able to have a nation that's displaying horrible behavior gain success due to the Midas Hadin. So those two things seem to be in contradiction. And the third objection might be, and this is really just a simple, more primitive objection, just Yonah is clearly a Navi. The entire job of a Navi is to spur people to do tshuva. That's what we read throughout the Nevi'im. So how could it be that we could really think that Yonah, as a Navi, would not understand the concept of tshuva? So due to those three objections, number one, the fact that we have the same formulation recorded in Sefer Yoel, number two, the historical background about Yonah's previous prophecy in Sefer Malachim, and number three, just the entire job of a Navi, how could it really be that approach number one could really be the case, that what was holding Yonah back was his inability to understand the confluence of both Amidas Hadin and Amidas Harachamim? So perhaps we have to come upon a new avenue to try to explain why Yonah was not able to fulfill God's mission until the very end. And that comes out really of the Abarbanel, and it also plays upon this historical analysis that we just gave from the Sefer Malachim. What's clear in Sefer Malachim? So what's clear there is that Yonah is dedicated, he's loyal to his nation. He very much wants his nation to succeed. That's why, I mean, he doesn't hesitate at all when God asks him to prophesy. To prophesy? Is that the verb? Prophesize. Yeah, okay. So to prophesize about the extension of the boundaries, right? So clearly he's very loyal to his nation, perhaps as many, if not all, of the Nevi'im were. So if you look inside at source number 7, we'll read the Abarbanel inside, he suggests something that's very intuitive. He says, V'hine Yonah hivin amitasa inyan, he understood the truth of the matter, V'lachin gomar b'libo, he decided fully, shalo l'aleches l'ninveh, k'dei shalo yinatzlu anshei Ashur mehakliya al yada. Remember, we mentioned earlier that Nineveh was a city in Ashur, right, in the kingdom of Assyria. And we know that Ashur was responsible for the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. That's what eventually happened in history after the time of Yonah. So Yonah basically is coming in with the following perspective. Yonah saying, as a loyal citizen, as a loyal leader of my Jewish nation, I don't want to help motivate and facilitate Nineveh's tshuva, because in the end, that's going to cause harm to my own nation. That's going to cause the Assyrian Empire to come and subjugate the Jewish nation, and then indirectly, I will have been the cause for the downfall of the Jewish people. So says the Abarbanel. And therefore, ki eich tiyeh halichaso siba lehatil esbenei Ashur lehachris esbenei Yisrael ve'eichacha yuchal v'yireh bara'a, playing off the lashon from Megillas Esther, asher yimtza esamo al yedei ha'ashurim. How could it be that Yonah could see the downfall of his people and realize that it was really his responsibility, if you think all those years back, to when he came to Nineveh and motivated Nineveh to do tshuva, Nineveh, the capital of Ashur? So that's based on the historical background of Malachim, where Yonah is basically extending the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael, and thereby saving the Jewish nation from outsider attack. Now, this approach of the Barmanel is found in earlier sources, even in Chazal. Chazal picked up on the fact that Yonah basically asks, really in very clear terms to commit suicide. He says to the sailors that he wants to give up his own life. So uni vahatiluni el hayah. That's in Perek Aleph, where Yonah says that I'd rather be thrown into the sea than have to fulfill the divine mission. So Rabbi Nassan picks up on that formulation and he explains that why would Yonah be so willing to give up his life in this instance? So Rabbi Nassan compares Yonah to other Nevi'im and other leaders of Klal Yisrael who were also willing to give up their lives on behalf of their nation. Their loyalty was to such a high degree that it expressed itself in the willingness to give up one's life. So even from Rabbi Nassan, even before the Abar Manal, we see this approach in Chazal that what was really holding Yonah back was his unwillingness to get Nineveh to do tshuva and thereby indirectly cause Klal Yisrael harm, and that's why he would have been thrown into the sea himself. Sauni vahati luni el hayah. So with the 10 minutes that we have left, so I'd like to kind of bring back these two approaches to the original question that we asked, which was why do we read Sefer Yonah on Yom Kippur? And the thing that we have to realize, after explaining both of these approaches, as to why Yonah was so disturbed by God's mission and so unwilling and flees in such an extreme way from what God wanted him to do, what we have to realize is that Sof Kol Sof, at the end of the Sefer, God essentially tells Yonah that you're incorrect, right? Your perspective was flawed. There was something that you misunderstood. You exhibited some lack of comprehension. There was something that you didn't pick up on, Yonah. Right? That's basically the message that God has for Yonah in Perek Dal. And the challenge for us is to understand what was missing in Yonah's perspective. What was God telling Yonah that he was not able to understand on his own? So I think that no matter which approach you take, whether approach number one, that's the contradiction between Midas HaDin and Midas HaRachamim, or approach number two, that it's about Yonah's loyalty to the Jewish nation, I think that both of those approaches come back to a common kernel. And that's to say as follows. I think that the underwriting theme in Sefer Yonah is that tshuva is not necessarily something that is completely and utterly logical. It's not, in its essence, a human type of phenomenon or a human creation. Tshuva is something which comes from above. It's a divine gift. If we were born and we kind of ruled the world with just our own capacities, we would not have necessarily come upon the concept of tshuva. Now let me just qualify that to make that very clear. Obviously we would want people who were wrongdoers to better their ways. We would in every way possible motivate people and help people and facilitate their coming back to a proper path. We don't want thieves to remain thieves. We don't want murderers to remain murderers. Obviously, we would try to help people come back to a proper way of life. But would we have necessarily come upon the concept of tshuva? Would we have necessarily come upon the phenomenon that someone could have done something wrong and admitted it and felt shameful for it and thereby avoid its grave consequence? Would we not have ruled the world in a kind of tit-for-tat, quid pro quo type of manner in which tshuva would not have been part of the fabric of our society? So it's certainly entirely possible. It's not something that would have been intuitive to us had we just been left to our own capacities. And that's something that Chazal pick up on in the Talmud Yerushalmi, which is a really incredible passage in source number 9, something that perhaps some of you have seen before, but if you haven't, then it's really worth seeing. So let's read it inside together. So, Sha'alu l'chachma, so chachma, intelligence, was asked, Chote mahu oncha, what's the punishment for a sinner? Amru lahem, chata'im tirdof ra'ah. So, sinners are going to follow their ways. Avira, goderes avira, sinners are going to remain sinners. Sha'alu l'nevu'ah, chote mahu oncho, amra lahem, hanefesh hachota'as hitamus. So what does the phenomenon of prophecy respond to what should be a sinner's punishment? So, you should get the proper consequence. Then Sha'alu l'kutcha brichu chote mahu oncho, amar lahen, yasu tshuva v'yiskapir lah. What is Yerushalmi trying to convey here? So I think it's exactly this message. And I heard this from my Rebbe Rav Rosenzweig as well. What the Yerushalmi is trying to say here is that tshuva is a divine gift. It's something that HaKadosh Baruch Hu creates and allows us, not only allows us, but demands of us that we take advantage of it. It's something with which HaKadosh Baruch Hu added to the creation and fabric of the world, that we would always have a way to come back towards Him, to better our relationship with Him, to come closer to His ways, no matter how far we fell off our path. That's God's addition to the world. Perhaps you could add to this discussion, which the Gemara and Nedarim records, and it's also found in the Midrash, that tshuva was one of the things that Chazal say was kodemes libriya. So it's always difficult to understand, what exactly does that mean? Right? What does it mean for something to have preceded the creation of the universe? So perhaps what it means is that it's not a natural consequence or outcome of there being a human world. Tshuva is something that had to precede the world because it comes from up top. It's something that the divine adds to creation, and then God makes tshuva as part of the fabric of our world. That's what it means that tshuva kodemes la'olam. It's the same type of idea from the Yishami of sha'alu l'kutcha b'richu chotei mahu oncho and yasa tshuva v'yiskaprimo. So I think that that's the overriding theme, the overarching theme that is really permeating throughout Sefer Yonah. And basically, no matter which approach you take, Yonah is expressing some type of intuition that tshuva doesn't always make sense from the human perspective. Certainly from our first approach, from avenue number one. So Yonah doesn't understand the entire notion of tshuva. How could you have Midas Hadin and Midas Harachamim coexist? It doesn't make any sense. Right? And then what Hashem is responding is that, look, you're right. It's not necessarily logical, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. It doesn't mean it's not true. I added it to the world, and I want all human beings to take advantage of it, and that's my message to you, Yonah. And avenue number two, approach number two, so Yonah doesn't understand why we would try to motivate a nation to do tshuva if in the future that's going to cause harm. But perhaps what's the message of the Ribono Shel Olam to Yonah? So based on the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, the concept of Ba'asher Husham, that sometimes from a logical human perspective, we might want to take into account the future. We might want to say, no, we shouldn't motivate these people to do tshuva because it's going to spur harm in the future. It's going to lead to terrible things. But says God, Ba'asher Husham, every single person, every individual, every community has the opportunity and the responsibility to do tshuva no matter what happened in his or her past and no matter what's going to happen in his or her future. That's Yonah's kind of flaw in his understanding, and that's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's response. And no matter which approach you take, they both come back to this common denominator that Hashem is saying to Yonah, tshuva is something of mine. It's something that I gave as a gift to humanity. It's something that I want it to take advantage of. Not only that I want it to take advantage of, but I'm going to demand that it take advantage of it. And therefore, I'm going to send you on a mission to get Nineveh to do tshuva. And if that's the case, then what better Haftorah to read on Yom Kippur? Yom Kippur is the ultimate day of tshuva. Rav Rosenzweig has pointed out in the past that according to many Rishonim, on Yom Kippur, there's a specific obligation of tshuva that's distinct from the obligation of tshuva from the rest of the year. There's a mitzvah of tshuva throughout the entire year. But on Yom Kippur, there's a unique obligation to do tshuva. Because Yom Kippur is a day unlike any other. Yom Kippur is the day on which we connect with the concept of tshuva, on which the concept of tshuva is most emphasized and most clarified, and it's the day on which we take most advantage of that concept. So what better day than Yom Kippur to read the story that is all about the core and essence of the phenomenon of tshuva? If in order to perform tshuva, we need to first understand that it's something that comes from God. It's something that Hashem has created, He's added to the world, He wants us to take advantage of it, He requires us that we take it of us that we take advantage of it. And from that perspective, when we come to Yom Kippur and we read Sefer Yonah at the very conclusion of our day, so what better way to kind of motivate us as our preface to Ni'ilah than to come to grips with the exact essence of what tshuva really is and thereby be able to take full advantage of the concept in all of its grandeur. So hopefully we'll be able to do that together this upcoming Shabbos Yom HaKippurim, and a Gemar Chasima Tova to all.
Thank you.